Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Africa. When I was 7, I was brought to this country and forced into a system I knew nothing about. This is me. I was held as a slave in a religious shrine.
What crime is this child paying for?
Her uncle committed adultery.
Thousands of women across West Africa have lost their freedom because of a practice called trokoshi. And it's still happening.
Does she know why she's here?
Now I'm on a journey to try and understand what happened. To find answers to questions I've had on my mind for years. What is trokoshi? And why did my family give me away?
This is Brigitte. Yeah, you're my Uber.
My name is Brigitte Sosu Perini. I live and work in Accra, the capital of Ghana. It's the city where I feel most free.
Did you just start it or morning?
Since morning.
But my first memories in this country are among my darkest. I was trafficked here from my home in neighboring Togo and held in captivity as part of a practice called trokoshi.
You never heard of their belief system, trokoshi?
Yes. It is even practiced in my hometown. And some people are still there.
Some girls are still there.
Yes, some girls are still there.
Trokoshi is illegal and it's not often talked about in Accra. But to my surprise, Richard tells me his own grandmother is living as a trokoshi.
But to them, they are self that are involved. They are not selling bad. The
because they believe in the system.
This same system robbed me of my childhood. 20 years later, I'm on a journey to understand what really happened. I was told I had to leave home to go and live with my uncle. I was placed on the back of a motorbike. I didn't even know the driver. I thought it was the strong wind causing my tears, but I think I was actually crying because I was being taken away from my family. And then I was left at a place I had never been before. I didn't even understand the language. They took away my clothes and wrapped me in a purple cloth. They even took away my name.
How old is this little girl?
7 years old.
Do you know why you're here?
In 1997, I was filmed by an American news crew at the place I was being held, a shrine run by a priest dedicated to the worship of deities. I was labeled a Trikoshi, a wife of the gods, paying for a crime committed by a family member.
Do you miss your parents?
Yes.
I remember feeling a range of emotions.
Neglect, rejection, isolation. Add into that the idea of that could have been my life. That could have been my life. That could have been my life. And that's why I feel like I don't watch it much.
But this report changed everything. With the help of a charity called International Needs, an American viewer flew to Ghana to negotiate my release. His name was Kenneth Parini, and he will become my adoptive father. He took me to the U.S., where I spent the next 13 years. I was relieved to be out after about a year in the shrine, but there was a huge emptiness that could never be filled.
I was still thinking about my Togolese family, my birth family. But it was in my heart and my mind. I never stopped thinking about them.
A few years later, my American dad and I agreed I should go and look for them. The charity that freed me helped me find my village and filmed my return. My family had no idea I was coming. I didn't even know if I'd find all of them alive.
Mama, I'm with Fabula.
I hadn't seen my mother since I was 7 years old. I found out I even had a little brother who I had never met. That day was so surreal, almost like a dream. Now that I'm older, I feel ready to explore the cultural background of Trikoshi. It's practiced in parts of Ghana, Togo and Benin by various ethnic groups, one of which is the Ewe. I'm driving into Ghana's Volta region, a lush area of lakes and rivers where Trikoshi is most prevalent. So right now we are following Richard, whom I met the first day of the journey. After our chat in the Uber taxi, Richard invited us into his community to speak with a group of Ewe elders. To mark our arrival, they were saying prayers and pouring libation to their gods.
sana alekere to do do owo do ro je to e ko ne ka tan sugbo e ke o ogana ya na wo ru ko e ba ko yin ko ya la ko gbo ko ya ko ya ko.
But they believe if you offend the gods, they can bring misfortune. I would like to know if there has ever been a human sacrifice. He's talking about Chokoshi, where you are banished from the community to pay for the crimes of your family. Another elder tells me that two of her relatives were sent to the shrine. Given this fear of punishment from the gods, I can understand why the Chokoshi practice has survived for over 300 years. But for me, life in the shrine meant no life at all. Each day, I was woken at 5 a.m. and sent to fetch water. I had to carry heavy buckets on my head. It was hard physical work for a child. I was made to sweep the compound and work long hours on the farm. I wasn't allowed to play or even go to school. I was in total isolation. On the campus of the University of Ghana, I am meeting up with Dr. Robert Ame and Reverend Walter Pingpong. They are both experts on the Chokoshi practice. They've spent their lives raising awareness of the abuses that go on in the shrine.
For the practice to be consummated, there was a need for the traditional priest to sleep with a virgin girl who comes in.
Sexual servitude was common, and many women will bear the children of the priests. I was liberated before puberty, so I didn't have to go through this. But I wanted to know why someone would serve time for another person's crime.
If it's believed that they have a right to select any member of their family to serve in their shrine, whether that person committed a crime or not, by the collective principles, they believe they are doing the right thing.
It's like one or two men within the family that gets to decide for the family.
Because those are their values. We are one.
When I left the shrine in 1997, there were about 5,000 Chokoshi women and children in Ghana alone. Thousands were liberated and Chokoshi was made illegal in 1998. But no priest has ever been prosecuted and the practice still goes on. I meet back up with Richard, the Uber driver, whose grandmother is still living as a Chokoshi.
Shortly we'll be going to see your grandmother. Could you tell me a bit more of how you feel about her being a Chokoshi?
After our grandfather slept there, she has been, since there were sickness, challenges happening in the family. So this our grandmother sacrificed herself for us.
So does that make you believe?
That's their belief. And as they give our grandmother out, all the sickness and the challenges stop. That is why we are happy for our grandmother to be there.
Like me, Richard's grandmother was given to a shrine to atone for a relative's sin.
Even if you're from the community, you can't, if someone believed in something for so many years and decades, and it's difficult to go to that person today and say what you're doing, what your belief systems are wrong, and expect that person to give up or to change their ways.
We drive to the town where Richard's grandmother is serving in a shrine.
Alugba is one of the few who became a Chokoshi after she married and had children.
Speaking to her, it seems she's happy to be serving as a Chokoshi because she believes it protects her family.
You're fine.
As night fell, a young Chokoshi girl wearing a blue cloth came to speak to me.
And she's saying that she's 14 years.
Does she know why she's here?
That's what she doesn't know.
You know, I'm going to pick up your fever. Togo.
I felt sad because she missed her mom, and I know how that feels. She came here 2 years ago at the age of 12, so she misses her mom, and I don't see how we can justify that. That's what it is. She misses home, and she wants to go home. She wants to be home.
For me, growing up without a mother was devastating. What kept me going was a few cherished memories of my early childhood. I remember my mom and dad and four siblings, all girls. I'm the second. I was closer to my dad. I think I was a daddy's girl. For dinner, he will build this big fire. He would dig the ground around it and roast corn, peanuts, sweet potatoes, and yam. It was so good. It was really good. I remember at night we would lie under the stars and the moon. Life was simple. I'm going to visit my family in Ahasome, the village in Togo where I was born. It's at least a day's journey from the Volta region in Ghana. Having been back for a few years, I felt apprehensive. I've spent my whole life wondering why they give me away, but I've never had the courage to ask. This time, I feel ready to find out the truth.
This is it. This is it. On the right. It's right here, on the right.
Since I left at the age of 7, I've lost my mother tongue. I've visited a handful of times, but I have to use a translator.
My younger sister and her baby.
I wanted to speak to my father. All I knew was that one of my uncles had sent for me, but I had never known what my father had agreed to
My uncle's house was in the capital, Lomé, a long way from my village. To find some answers, my father went to a soothsayer.
Are you aware now where I was taken? He took me to Ghana, Volta region of Ghana, and I was placed in a shrine. He left me. I was supposed to be there for the rest of my life.
You're not understanding me. I don't want to use the word blame. For many years, I was sad because I was not with my family. But now, I'm ready to put that behind me. If I was angry at my family, if I wanted to blame, I won't be here. I won't. Sometimes it's easier just to carry on with your life, accept the way things are, wanting to discover who you are, and when things don't make sense, tracing your roots and asking questions is too much. The emotions are too much and the weight is too much. Right now, my head hurts. I have a headache.
Last night's conversation with my dad was really difficult, but I needed to know the truth.
I was dwelling on the fact that I couldn't communicate with them and that I was taken away, and that's why I can't speak French, that's why I can't speak Ewe. I was taken away, so I was sort of dwelling on the negative.
My parents were lied to. They thought they sent me to live with my uncle to get a better education. They didn't choose to send me to the shrine. And that was a huge weight off my mind.
From this point forward, we can only build. And the last few days is a start to building that bridge. It's a start to building that relationship, building that connection.
I'm back in the Volta region of Ghana, close to the village where I was held captive in the shrine. Being here is not easy for me. But feeling the love of my family has given me strength to return.
I was a young girl that I was doing the chores with. Her name was Christiana. She was the only one I remember.
We parked up near the shrine. I was paralyzed with fear. What I remember about this place is pain and loneliness and sadness. And isolation, and getting out and walking about doesn't feel natural to me. I wanted to see if Christiana was still here. I found her still living in the town. 20 years after we were both freed, we recognized each other right away.
Do you know who I am? Who am I?
You are my dear sister. Thank God for your life.
Thank God for your life.
We haven't seen each other in so long.
I miss you.
Thank you.
I miss you too. I've always thought of you.
After spending 5 years in the shrine, Christiana was also freed after appearing in the 1997 news report. She had never seen it before.
Are you happy here? Do you want to run away? And why don't you run away? Where are your parents?
They died.
When my father died, I stopped going to school, even though I had wanted to become a doctor. I feel very sad, because by staying here, I have lost my chance at an education.
But that's not your life anymore. You're out. Why are you crying? What's wrong?
I'm supposed not to be here. And I feel like mine.
Yes, we were not supposed to be in there, but we are out now. We are out now.
It was amazing to hear about Christiana's life outside of the shrine.
I'm free. I can decide to go to anywhere. Today I can eat. If I say today I'll eat 10, I can eat if only I have money.
Mm-hmm.
I can wear anything at all.
She showed me her tattoo celebrating her reclaimed name.
How does it make you feel when you look at that?
I feel happy.
Why?
Because I am that I am. That's my name.
Yes.
The name that my parents gave me.
Sometimes your past is worth getting back to, not to hold you back, but to strengthen your future. My deep faith in God and the love of my family and friends have allowed me to grow into the person I was born to be.
Somebody decided that we were supposed to be alive. It's incredible that we've been given a second chance to have life.
Remember, this bulletin is streaming live on 3news.com. It is also live on DSTV channel 279. We settle for the big one. Others of Chokosi shrines at Kleko in the K2 South Municipality of the Volta region have rejected accusations the practice is an abuse of the rights of young girls and that Chokosi young teenage virgin girls are sent to fetish shrines for several years to atone for offenses committed by their family members. In the first of a two-part story, Nana Kweku Edua brings you the inside story of Chokosi.
According to the Chokosi tradition practiced in the Volta region among the Tong and Anlons, virgin girls are given to village priests as a way of appeasing the god for crimes committed by family members. The word Chokosi in the Ewa language means slaves of the gods. Kleko, in the Kete South municipality of the Volta region, is well known for the practice of Chokosi. But to meet the priests and elders of the various shrines and get closer to the shrines, one must take off shirts and shoes. Several minutes of deliberations, elders decided to answer some pertinent questions bothering the minds of many concerning the activities.
You keep virgin girls here around you. You don't allow them go anywhere. They are taken by some of you, and then they are kept here until they grow old and they die.
That's why you're talking about. You're asking me. It's not like that. Truly, we receive images. See, that is the fear shiris. When they are brought, the first rituals was performed for them instantly. So they go back to their hometown. The second one, if they are, the family is ready, they are prepared, they come. It is performed for them. Then they go back. Even if they are school going ages people, they are still going to school. They go back for their schools. We don't keep them there.
Does the trokosi practice discriminate against women and children?
Fiashiri, they are queen mothers. Everybody respects them. Even you are not allowed to beat her. If you venture, you beat her, you destroy yourself. The deity will not allow you.
Some fetish priests and shrine owners have been accused of having absolute sexual control over their slaves, and they have also been accused of raping them, with the claim that trokosi slaves are like priestesses who make love with the gods through their earthly servants, the priests. So we caught up with a 16-year-old who was brought to the shrine some 2 weeks ago.
Adi omo ye eye e ade papa so omo do be ma ba show bia na e ade papa na o so say ye ka tin kan ye o so say ye na e.
I was just finding out from her, this is a young child who is here, whether her coming here is good or not. She think it's a good thing for her to be kept here or not, and she's finding it difficult to really answer me on that. She says she's okay here.
Many like her, we learned, have been given the free will to decide what they want to do for themselves to improve their lives while at the shrines. Although some of these girls may wish to rejoin their families as soon as possible, they may have to wait a little longer until they finish the atonement of sins they never committed. From Kleko, Nana Kwekwedia for TV3 News.
So let's stay on this very issue. Bright Apia is the Executive Director of Child Rights International and joins us on phone to discuss this issue. Good evening, sir, and thanks for your time.
Good evening.
Now, will you categorize this particular practice as a child rights abuse and why?
Yes, this is a clear violation of child rights, in the sense that if you look at the concept itself, it is not something that children themselves will do, but somebody who has done it, and children must be sent there to for the atonement of a sin that somebody else has committed. So one, it is not done with the consent of the child, which the law provides that should be the case, that there are instances that children should give consent to the things that they do. But if you look at the way it is, it's a compelling thing that while that thing has been committed against the gods, somebody must be there to serve. So clearly, that itself violates the right of the child. And then the issue of whether or not at a certain age children can even go there, because by law, a child can only be responsible in terms of criminal activities at the age of 12 years, and in this case, you cannot even classify it as a criminal activity. So the law provides certain things that you cannot do against children, especially where any act at all takes the child out of the classroom, or it becomes some kind of a torture, or emotional torture, or whatever torture that you call it, to the child. then that will also amount to the violation of the child's right. But if you look at the fundamental principle, the basis for which this practice is done, it has nothing to do with the child. It's not as if the child has committed any offense and all that. So right from the beginning, you realize that it's not an act that really supports the right of children. So whatever, whichever way we look at it, it's not something that we should even get children involved in it at all. Whoever has committed the offense, by their own culture, they believe in their own principle and think that somebody must serve for it. And I think that the person who has committed it must be the same person to serve for it. I don't think that children should suffer the consequences of the actions of somebody. You know, so those are the things that, for us, we need to also begin to look at and then send a signal out there for people to know so that we can preserve the dignity of children, because there are a lot of things that come with it. You know, but the privacy and dignity of the child must also be protected. And the child must also go in a safe and protective environment. But once we cannot guarantee that, then I don't see why any act whatsoever within the context of culture should put children into such kind of slavery conduct. And this is an act that the state itself has taken both steps to say that it is something that we need to abolish. You know, so if the state has taken that position and all children belong to the state, I think that if some of these are going on, the state apparatus must be there to also ensure that they deal with some of these issues once and for all.
Now, what should be the approach of the gender ministry in addressing the negatives of trokosi without hurting tradition? Because we know in several parts of the country, this tradition is very strong there.
Yes, of course, it is. But the issue is that the state has taken a position that trokosi is not an act that we should practice against our children. Children should not be involved in it at all. So when the state has taken position on that, then within that, the state must also ensure that they have strategies to deal with it. But if I'm to handle this issue, I think that we've passed a level where, because we've had a lot of engagement with these people, some also listen to the issue that we raised, and some also are still practicing the act under the umbrella of saying that they are not violating their rights, it's a normal practice, those who want to go to school, they allow them to go and all that. We've heard all those things over and over again. But this is something that the state has taken a position. So the state must ensure that once they are not ready to listen, certain action must also come to bear to ensure that they safeguard children from this kind of act. You know, so it is not that we want to say that trokosi is a bad system. It is for a group of people who believe in the principles of it. But once the state has enacted the law, that state that in all matters, the interest of the child should be paramount. That should be our golden rule, and that should be what should guide all of us. So with that principle, the state must ensure that they take all the necessary steps to deliver those children, place them in an environment that will be conducive for them, so that their dignity and privacy would also be preserved by the state. So those are the things that, for me, if there's any recommendation that I would make to the gender ministry, these are the things that I would say, that the steps that they have to take to ensure that they get these children out of that situation.
Indeed, you did indicate that most of the camps have been closed. A few others are still in operation. How do we confront this? How do we who are in this act that indeed This practice is an abuse of human rights, especially that of the children that they use?
I think that it's engagement is the first step that we need to take, and we've done that in the past. And if there need be, we should still continue to do that. Because in the past, if you look at the people who are managing the shrine and all that, also, in terms of their educational level, you cannot compare it to those who are doing it now. You know, so there's some level of there's a level playing field where we can engage them for them to also understand. Yes, we know that in the past, professors have written articles to justify this practice and all that. But that notwithstanding, I think that the engagement process must still go on, because this is something that they've done for many years. So it's not just take a day to be able to deal with it. So the engagement process must still be ongoing. It should be a continuous thing that we should do until they come to the realization that this is the position of the state, and this is what the state want to do. Therefore, everybody must fall in line with it and all that. So the engagement for me should still continue, and then to see how best we can protect our children.
Grateful for your time on News at 10. Brighter Pierre is the Executive Director of Child Rights International. He's been speaking to us about Trokosi on and all the negative effects that we are currently experiencing in this country. That is it for the big one.
It's called Trokosi, and it means wife or slave of the gods. It's an ancient West African tradition that to this day enslaves thousands of women and young girls, some as young as 7 years old. They're condemned to a life of slave labor and sexual servitude, not because they did anything wrong, but because someone in their family committed a crime, sometimes generations ago. And to pay for the crime, their families must send young virgins to be the slaves of tribal priests, often for the rest of their lives.
This is a Trokosi slave girl, right? A Trokosi girl.
How old is this little girl?
7 years old.
Do you know why you're here?
No.
What crime is this child paying for?
My,
her uncle committed adultery.
Do you like it here? Do you miss your parents?
Yes.
Slavery in this part of Africa is nothing new. Hundreds of years ago, at the height of the slave trade, the Volta River was one of its main highways. Millions of slaves were shipped to the Americas from coastal villages like these. But today, more than a century after slavery was abolished, thousands of young girls are held in bondage up and down this river. To find the girls and the priests, we had to travel to some of West Africa's most isolated places, deep in marshlands of the Volta River, in villages where Christianity is still seen as a hostile intrusion. This is where we found the tribal priest Gidisu, attended by one of his 10 slave wives. But before anyone would even talk to us, we had to appease the gods with $10 and a couple of bottles of hard liquor.
I know for me, sir. Me can tell me, sir. I go on me.
Tell me, what is your problem with our religion that you've come all the way from your country to find out about it?
We want to understand why young girls are made to pay for the sins or the crimes of their family members.
It is our fetish gods that demand the girls. Death will strike your family unless you bring a young virgin to us.
And that's how a life of slavery begins for thousands of African girls. They are brought to these shrines or village churches when they are still children, and they may stay until they die. They are meant to marry the gods, but it's the priests who'll stand in. By day, the priests make them work in their homes and on their farms. By night, they demand sex, and they don't have to pay the girls, clothe them, or even feed them.
Trokosis are not slaves. How can the person I marry be a slave?
Do you think these girls are happy to be your wife? They haven't chosen you. Are they happy?
Ooh, fine.
But it's not fine for Akuponyo. Today, she becomes a Trokosi slave. She's not allowed to talk to us, to tell us what she thinks. She doesn't have to. Akuponyo is carrying her dowry on her head and the money she's collected to support herself as a Trokosi slave. She hasn't committed any crime, but years ago, her great-grandfather murdered someone. And according to these people's traditions, Akuponyo is the latest young woman to have to pay for the sins of her ancestors. Family members accompany Akuponyo on her six-mile walk to the tribal priest. They are sacrificing her because they believe that otherwise the gods will bring death to the family to punish them for their forefathers' crimes. It is a never-ending cycle of fear, says Akuponyo's uncle.
Whatever the custom demands for the death to stop, that's what the family will do, even though it's so painful for us.
It's a public ritual of humiliation. Akuponyo has to walk a gauntlet of jeering villagers and beg them for money. The tribal priest she will serve is Maku.
As far as I'm concerned, it is good because it deters others from committing crimes.
We saw her from the beginning when she was waiting to come here, crying a lot. Why do you think she was crying if it's so good?
If you see her weeping, she's crying from joy.
But Akuponyo's humiliation continues inside this hut that's their holy shrine. She's supposed to become the wife of a god, but in reality, one of the priests can take her as a slave for work and for sex. What you are seeing are the secret rituals of atonement that have never before been filmed. Everything from Akuponyo's former life must now be stripped away. Her clothes, her beads, her earrings, and finally her pride. The work of a slave begins at dawn. There are 21 in Maku's village.
There's two over there.
We wanted to meet some of them, so we asked Maku to show us around. There is this little girl who was brought in just 2 weeks ago, and there are old women who've been here all their lives.
If you had been able to choose, how would you have spent your life? What would you have done?
They brought me here so young, I had no say in my life. Now that I'm about to die, I don't care what happens to me.
But even a whole life of servitude doesn't pay off a debt to the gods. Girls keep paying for the same offense from generation to generation.
You're the replacement for your sister who died?
Yes.
Are you happy here?
I guess.
In private, Christine told us a different story.
You will become the wife of a priest? Do you want to? Huh? No. Do you want to run away?
Yes, I want to run away.
And why don't you run away? Where are your parents?
My parents died.
They died?
For the 5 years she's been here, Christine has been forced to trade in her school books for hard labor.
When my father died, I stopped going to school, even though I had wanted to become a doctor. I feel very sad because by staying here, I have lost my chance at an education.
This is the future awaiting Christine if she stays in the shrine, chasing away the birds that scavenge the priest's harvest and bearing the priest's children. Even if they can run away, the world they find outside is not much kinder. Once branded a Trokozi slave, their families don't want them back.
When I ran away from the priest, life was so hard. People ran away from me. Even my relatives turned their backs.
Mercy Senyale is still an outcast after running away from a priest who kept her enslaved for 15 years. And all because her great-grandmother stole a pair of gold earrings. She has three children now. The priest first forced himself on her when she was 11 years old.
The first night, he wanted to sleep with me, and I refused. So he beat me so hard, my cries woke up all the other slave girls. And I finally gave in.
Can you tell us about the priest?
The priest is not very big, but he's very wicked.
This is the priest Mercy served, Togbe Aklidopo. By day, he's a government official with the Ministry of Health. By night, he's a husband to 10 slaves who've borne him 60 children.
That is my son.
We've talked to one girl at least who's spoken to us about your shrine, and she said that you beat her, that you forced her to work with no money, that she hardly had anything to eat, and that you forced her to sleep with you when she was 11 years old.
And you believe it? Do you believe it?
I'm asking you.
That's what I'm also asking. Do you believe that story is never correct?
all the girls, all the wives you take, do they all accept your advances? Do they all want to sleep with you, or do they have to?
Having sex with a woman depends on love and affection. If the woman is not willing, you can't force it.
Is the priest lying then when he tells us that everybody was happy and everybody was treated well?
He is telling lies. He's telling a big lie. So many of us couldn't stand the suffering, we had to run away.
Anyone who ran away was brought back by their parents and repeatedly raped again in this very building. Later, some of the girls were helped by Reverend Walter Pingpong.
The sad part of it is that your parents brought you, or your family brought you, so if you ran to them, they bring you back. You know, you just can't escape. International needs does not want to replace the fetish priest.
Reverend Pingpong now leads the campaign to end slavery in Ghana. He's trying to convince the priest to set the girls free.
Most of the priests that we've encountered are farmers, and so we give them cows.
And what do they say when you say, here's a cow and a sheep for this 10-year-old girl? What do they say? They say, great?
No, a lot of them will ask us, do you want me to go to bed with a cow or a goat? And I'm sorry, but this is about, you know, the understanding that some of them have. You know, there is some value to these girls that they can't really have in cows and goats.
Which is sex.
Which is sex, literally.
Reverend Pingpong has managed to free these 31 women from their priests for 5 cows and about $1,000. At this liberation ceremony, the blood of a slaughtered goat marks the darkness of slavery and death. The white headbands mark freedom. The slaves' symbolic chains are cut, and they jump from one world to the next. So far, 436 slaves have gone through these rituals and have been set free, but thousands more remain in captivity. And according to Togbay, the tribal priest, that's where they'll stay.
This practice was in existence before the white men came to Ghana. I shall also continue till I die.
Nigeria is in the grip of a kidnapping epidemic. Heavily armed gangs terrorize cities, towns, and highways.
These are some of the weapons that we have recently recovered from bandits.
Wow.
We don't even use this in the police.
They seem to take anyone at will.
This is the evidence of beatings. I was tortured.
Ordinary citizens, businessmen, even kings.
Our people are really tortured, and the pain is unquantifiable.
With the Nigeria police ranked as the country's most corrupt institution, no citizen can feel safe from the kidnappers.
It was terrifying. I felt that was the end for me because I had never seen a gun to my face like that, not so close.
How many people would you say that you've killed?
I've killed more than 50 persons.
But the new anti-kidnap unit, led by Nigeria's most famous cop, Deputy Police Commissioner Abba Kyari, claims they are the answer.
The whole country and the state are looking up to IRT to see that these guys are arrested and brought to justice. And we'll see to that.
They say they'll clear out the gangs and bring back the rule of law. But are innocent citizens getting rounded up or even tortured in the process?
Operatives of the IRT, they're involved in all manner of abuses, you know, torture, brutality.
Is this unit the answer to Nigeria's kidnap crisis, or just more of the same corruption and violence that has plagued policing here for decades?
Okay, wait first. Stay like that.
Northern Nigeria. Armed bandits roam the countryside on the outskirts of major towns and cities. For years, they have terrorized local highways, kidnapping and murdering. Thousands of people have been taken, millions of dollars in ransoms paid.
Nigeria is facing a kidnapping epidemic, and anybody can be a victim anytime. I've come to Abuja to meet an elite police unit taking the fight to the kidnappers and to find out if they're the solution to one of the biggest problems facing my country.
The Intelligence Response Team, or IRT, was set up specifically to tackle kidnapping and armed robbery. Combining old-fashioned detective work with the latest technology has allowed them to track down and capture a who's who of Nigerian kidnappers since 2015. As a reporter who has spent over a decade covering crime in Nigeria, I've been invited to spend 3 weeks embedded with this unit to see how they work firsthand.
You're welcome to the Intelligence Response Team office in Abuja.
Assistant Police Commissioner Sonny Ubua is second in command of the IRT.
The way the structure of the IRT is that we have the headquarters and the command and control center in Abuja, but we have some offices in each geopolitical zone of the country. So this is where the coordination happens. So, yeah, morning, gentlemen.
The first stop on Sonny's tour of the unit's headquarters is the intelligence hub at the center of all its operations.
This is where all the analysis of the intelligence we generate is done. Then the product of this analysis is what we give to the team that goes out to the field for the actual operation.
What you're saying is that what gets out of this office can actually mean life or death for your men out in the field.
Definitely, definitely. Because if we miss a target here, they will fail in their mission. And we've recorded so far over 90% success in all the operations that we've had to carry out with the intelligence generated from here.
So there's no voodoo room somewhere?
Nowhere, no mystical powers, nothing. It's just young men and women dedicated to the duty, to their job, committed. So this is the secret, nothing more.
Thank you.
Sonny's own dedication and nerve was severely tested in 2017 when his wife and baby daughter were kidnapped by bandits from the family home.
I was really scared. It made me understand what happens to a family who have suffered kidnapping.
After working around the clock for 4 days, Sonny and his team say they captured the kidnappers and freed his wife and daughter.
Did that cement your confidence in your men to deliver at critical periods?
Look, it was a perfect operation. It was. It made me so proud. In fact, that was the aspect of the whole experience that gives me even more confidence, knowing that we can always get whoever. We can always get whoever, no matter where they think they are.
Back out in the yard, we cross paths with an ongoing investigation.
This is a unit on their way out again on a mission. These are freshly arrested suspects, and the team is getting ready to move out with them for further arrest, to trace their gang members, or maybe to search their houses for weapons or wherever they say their weapons are. Yes.
IRT often offers suspects incentives in return for leading officers to the rest of the gang.
I want to show you something now.
Okay.
Yeah. These are some of the weapons that we have recently recovered from bandits.
Wow.
They're about to go into storage.
Okay.
These are chain bullets and a general purpose machine gun.
Wow.
All of these were recovered recently during an operation in Benue State. These are sacks of ammunition. You can see them. All of them are recovered from hoodlums. Along with hand grenades and tear gas canisters. We also have here a rocket launcher, which we also recovered from the bandits. So you can see the level of their weaponry. We don't even use this in the police. Yeah, these are purely military hardware. Yeah, you know, not too many people understand that this is what we face on a daily basis, having to encounter people who are heavily armed, and probably operating on hard drugs. So they're very daring with them, yes.
Sonny's insights are revealing. But I'm also anxious to meet IRT's number one man, the unit's founder and leader, Deputy Police Commissioner Abba Kyari.
Hello, Commander.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Great to meet you, sir.
Ms. Kunle, she's from the BBC.
He's the youngest high-ranking officer in the Nigerian police force. With an arrest sheet of notorious kidnappers and armed robbers that has earned him the nickname Nigeria's Jack Bauer, as well as a host of policing medals and commendations.
When this place was set up, you were the first commander.
Yeah, sure. I am the pioneer commander, yeah.
What was the real idea? Was it felt that there is need for a unit that is solely based on intelligence?
You know, when this new administration came in, they decided that there should be a special unit that should be created, who are going to be trained on how to use intelligence to go out in the field and get the people arrested. So that unit is named the Intelligence Response Team. You know, it's all about intelligence. So anybody that we're going to go after, we have to be sure of it before we go after the person. We just don't go blindly and arrest somebody to him. It's very important to send the message to the criminals that Gary and his people will follow you wherever you are, and they will never forget.
It's not long before I get a chance to see Abba Kyari in action. News is breaking of a major case in the troubled northwest state of Kaduna, one of Nigeria's main kidnapping hotspots. A traditional ruler in the southern part of the state has just been murdered in an apparent kidnapping gone wrong. The entire state has been placed under a 24-hour curfew. Abba Kyari has been charged by his superiors with traveling to the King's Palace immediately and spearheading the investigation.
This kidnapping and the King has brought a lot of tension in the state. The whole country and the state are looking up to IRT to see that these guys are arrested and brought to justice. And we'll see to that.
The King initially looked like he would be handed back to his family after a ransom of 10 million naira or $30,000 was paid. But at the last moment, one of the kidnappers executed him instead with two gunshots to the head. On arrival at the palace, Abba Kyari is introduced to the late King's wife, Victoria Galadima, who was kidnapped alongside him, though she was later released. He asks how she was handled by the kidnappers.
This is the evidence of beatings. I was tortured.
And mommy, they're like, how many?
They were nine.
Even when they were going with you inside the bush?
Yes, they were nine in number.
High profile case, the money I get for our that solving case then. So the guy said that the faru, I got up and they faru, the Kasana Sanji Kuma is very bad. Abu the Akai, to Shesa IG now directed Zoom Michigan investigation and then where we should trace where in the industry Musamo so that they will come and face justice. That would escape.
Then the only thing you can do to give us the courage to believe that the government is concerned is to fish out these perpetrators of this evil act.
Yes, sir.
And bring them to justice, as you have said. We therefore say thank you, and we hope that you will do your work with our fear and favor. Thank you very much for coming. You are welcome.
This case threatens to ignite ethnic tensions in an already volatile region of Nigeria. It's essential that IRT's actions are swift and decisive if retaliatory violence is to be avoided. The King's driver, Timothy Kattari, was kidnapped alongside him and stayed with his chief to the end, narrowly escaping the same fate.
You can see where the bullet entered and came out.
Now, Timothy is recovering from his injuries in hospital.
The police will
say, it can be the same, but I'm good for the same family. I'm going to talk to you.
They were marched around 25 kilometers into the thick bush.
you know, the 100 million naira, your boss is justification. Let me get another chance to be able to do it. So, I'm going to get to the same thing. So, I'm going to get to the
After 5 days, the kidnappers reduce the ransom and allow their victims to communicate with the chief staff so the ransom could be delivered.
Around 5 o'clock, I come to the secretary. The driver then got up to the secretary. I'm going to check my body. So I say, ah, to me, I can't deny the money. Sumuwa mota a kwalta su bar mu za mu kai to lokacin da ya same na nan ban ji ba kawai sai na ce wayo Allah sai na ga kawai sai ya wuna ma mai gira na kai kawai tau daga na ce ku duba nan aka duba nan aka ganga mai gira na yana kwance ba
From what we discovered altogether, like 8 people have been killed by this group in this very operation. So it's an extremely deadly group.
Do you think that this same group might have been involved in some brutal kidnapping in the past where they've killed people?
Yes, it's possible. You know, there are so many other kidnappings where people have been killed around Kaduna, all over. And it's all by this kind of people. I hope you understand.
Abba Kiari's investigation continues. We head out to the very stretch of road where 1 week earlier, Timothy, the king and the king's wife, were taken from their vehicle and marched into the bush, and where four of their entourage were murdered in cold blood. District Police Officer John Hammond was the first policeman to respond to the scene and witness the carnage the kidnappers had left behind.
What are we looking at right now?
They're coming from this side.
Yeah.
When they're coming from this side, the chief's vehicle stopped here.
Yeah.
So they have, the orderly have noticed that there are armed robbers. So he removed his chevron from there. When he came here, he noticed that they discovered that he's a policeman because the horse
yeah.
of the pistol is yeah. with him here. So when they noticed that, they dragged him down. Shooting.
Yeah, so, and you can see the spot where the bullet hit.
Yes.
You can see the small hole. So you can see that some people are already on the ground, mm-hmm. and these guys went ahead to
shoot them
in
the head.
Yeah, shoot them and kill them. So it's very sad, very bad. But by God's grace, we're going to get them. They will most surely answer for this thing.
You can see the other one here too. You can see the spot. This is where they just
fired the first.
Never experienced this. I'm telling you, it's too sad.
Very, very sad.
Following a 6-month investigation, operators from IRT arrested the suspected ringleader and charged him with the kidnapping and murder of the king. But for thousands of other Nigerians, the trauma of kidnapping is something they must face alone, with little hope that their abductors will ever be brought to justice. I've arranged to meet two men who were freed from a kidnapping ordeal just 1 week earlier.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Sir? My name is Kunle.
I'm Paul.
Nice to
welcome to my home.
Nice to meet
Please
you.
Come in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Paul Dama and Spencer Nguto Tobago were kidnapped while driving along a major expressway. In recent years, Nigeria's highways have become high-risk kidnap zones.
I was the one driving, and it was around 4:30 p.m. We got to a full local government area in Kogi State. And then suddenly we heard a loud gunshot. And of course, I stepped off the accelerator. Then four or five of them came out from the bushes. All of them had AK-47 rifles. So the sound was quite loud. It was terrifying. They came out and were shooting sporadically in the air and pointing the guns at us in the car. And we came out of the car and they asked us to lie on the floor. And of course, at that moment, I felt that was the end for me because I had never seen a gun to my face like that, not so close.
Paul and Spencer were forcefully marched into the deep forest for hours. Their captors only allowed them to stop once they were around 20 kilometers from the main road. Escape was now impossible.
They now told us that we had been kidnapped and that we're going to call our families and friends to begin to send money, because they only let us go after the payment of a ransom of 10 million naira each.
How did that make you feel?
I was scared. I was really, really scared. Because I started to imagine the trauma my family members were going to go through.
Their friends and family were unable to raise such a huge sum. For 2 days, they begged the kidnappers to lower their demands while Paul and Spencer were beaten and tortured, often while their relatives listened on the phone.
They meant business because they were beating us and they were very serious. They told us that this is no joke, this is no play, this is the business they do. In fact, at that point, the first night they told us that there's a shrine they have, that when they want to kill you, they take you there and kill you.
Finally, the bandits agreed to 1 million naira in exchange for each of their lives. 4 days after they were lifted from the highway, a friend dropped the ransom cash off at the bandits' chosen location and both were released. They were lucky. In Nigeria, many kidnapping victims are killed by their captors even after the ransom has been paid.
Are you the same person you were before you were kidnapped?
No, absolutely not. It has really given me an entirely new perspective to life generally and what kidnapping in Nigeria is. So I think it's going to remain in my mind for a long time, I guess, before it. And I don't think it will ever go off.
I bet if you hear a gunshot now...
I'm going to be really, really, really scared. I don't even want to hear it.
1 week on from their release, Paul and Spencer's hopes for justice rest solely on the actions of Abba Kyari and his team.
I want them to face the full wrath of the law, because if we don't comb these things away from our society, we're in for serious trouble.
Paul and Spencer were kidnapped leaving the town of Anfa, traveling along one of the highways that link Abuja with the major towns and commercial centers of northern Nigeria. We're on the same stretch of road Paul and Spencer were taken from. IRT team leader Maji Mohammed has been assigned to investigate.
So what does each person here do?
Of course, I'm the team leader. I coordinate virtually everything in the team. Clement, he has a specialty in tracking.
Wow.
He traces the main target with the intelligence. Then James here, he has that skill. He has the major quality and ability to actually get to the target.
Based on Paul and Spencer's victim statements, IRT suspect a known kidnapping gang from the Fulani tribe is responsible for taking them. It's a high-risk operation, and the suspects have home advantage.
Is this the most dangerous stretch of road in Nigeria?
Yeah, it's amongst the most dangerous roads in Nigeria, because these are, as you can observe, there's no human life existing within this area. These are thick forest, thick bush, very thick bush. So it's very, very dangerous, because you never can tell when they'll come out to strike, and that's a good hideout for the criminals.
According to IRT, 90% of kidnappers they have arrested in the past year have identified themselves as Fulani. Traditionally known as a peaceful people, the expansion of organized farming has driven the Fulanis off the pastoral lands they once grazed their cattle on. Left destitute but accustomed to surviving in the thick forest which line the highways, they have found themselves drawn into and uniquely well equipped for kidnapping. IRT's intelligence team has pinpointed one of the key suspects in the case. They are in luck. He's out of the bush and in town.
This is the perfect time to go after them, because they are more relaxed now. They are not armed. They are within town. So we just need to go undercover. That's why I'm taking off my uniform. I don't want any identity or anything, because we are going there fully on operation now. So.
The team goes straight into action and pick up the suspect. He's still in possession of a ransom phone. It even has a logo on the back associated with bandit groups based in the bush.
Mostly they use
the big
source from the Fulani.
From the Fulani.
They use for negotiation of the ransoms.
This is a major breakthrough in tracking down Paul and Spencer's kidnappers. The suspect appears ready to crack and gives up the man he says is the real mastermind behind the abduction. He's even prepared to set a trap.
My brother, the best way to know is
about that. Calm down. Now, I want to
take this. I will say, that person where you will talk about the cow. The person is already, I will take this.
The man makes several attempts to call the alleged ring leader, but his phone is switched off. That evening, he sees his missed calls and rings back.
Okay, where are they now? Go to Kurud. Okay, for one girl, we get yash. Okay, I'll come.
The team head out in an unmarked car, hoping to snatch the alleged ring leader. They find him in a bar with two other apparent gang members. The suspects are seized and taken into custody. The unit's main suspect is adamant he wasn't involved in the kidnapping. He says he's a simple cattle herder. Nigeria is in the grip of a kidnapping epidemic. Heavily armed gangs terrorize cities, towns, and highways.
These are some of the weapons that we have recently recovered from bandits.
Wow.
We don't even use this in the police.
They seem to take anyone at will.
This is the evidence of beatings. I was tortured.
Ordinary citizens, businessmen, even kings.
Our people are really tortured, and the pain is unquantifiable.
With the Nigeria police ranked as the country's most corrupt institution, no citizen can feel safe from the kidnappers.
It was terrifying. I felt that that was the end for me because I had never seen a gun to my face like that, not so close.
How many people would you say that you've killed?
I've killed more than the 50 persons.
But the new anti-kidnap unit, led by Nigeria's most famous cop, Deputy Police Commissioner Abakiari, claims they are the answer.
The whole country and the state are looking up to IRT to see that these guys are arrested and brought to justice. And we'll see to that.
They say they'll clear out the gangs and bring back the rule of law. But are innocent citizens getting rounded up or even tortured in the process?
Operatives of the IRT, they're involved in all manner of abuses. You know, torture, brutality.
Is this unit the answer to Nigeria's kidnap crisis or just more of the same corruption and violence that has plagued policing here for decades?
Okay, wait first. Say like that.
Northern Nigeria. Armed bandits roam the countryside on the outskirts of major towns and cities. For years, they have terrorized local highways, kidnapping and murdering. Thousands of people have been taken, millions of dollars in ransoms paid.
Nigeria is facing a kidnapping epidemic, and anybody can be a victim anytime. I've come to Abuja to meet an elite police unit taking the fight to the kidnappers and to find out if they're the solution to one of the biggest problems facing my country.
The Intelligence Response Team, or IRT, was set up specifically to tackle kidnapping and armed robbery. Combining old-fashioned detective work with the latest technology has allowed them to track down and capture a who's who of Nigerian kidnappers since 2015. As a reporter who has spent over a decade covering crime in Nigeria, I've been invited to spend 3 weeks embedded with this unit to see how they work firsthand.
You're welcome to the Intelligence Response Team office in Abuja.
Assistant Police Commissioner Sonny Ubua is second in command of the IRT.
The way the structure of the IRT is that we have the headquarters and the command and control center in Abuja, but we have some offices in each geopolitical zone of the country. So this is where the coordination happens. So, yeah, morning, gentlemen.
The first stop on Sonny's tour of the unit headquarters is the intelligence hub at the center of all its operations.
This is where all the analysis of the intelligence we generate is done. Then the product of this analysis is what we give to the team that goes out to the field for the actual operation.
What you're saying is that what gets out of this office can actually mean life or death for your men out in the field.
Definitely, definitely. Because if we miss a target here, they will fail in their mission. And we've recorded so far over 90% success in all the operations that we've had to carry out with the intelligence generated from here.
So there's no voodoo room somewhere?
Nowhere, no mystical powers, nothing. It's just young men and women dedicated to the duty, to their job, committed. So this is the secret, nothing more.
Thank you.
Sonny's own dedication and nerve was severely tested in 2017 when his wife and baby daughter were kidnapped by bandits from the family home.
I was really scared. It made me understand what happens to a family who have suffered kidnapping.
After working around the clock for 4 days, Sonny and his team say they captured the kidnappers and freed his wife and daughter.
Did that cement your confidence in your men to deliver at critical periods?
Look, it was a perfect operation. It was. It made me so proud. In fact, that was the aspect of the whole experience that gives me even more confidence, knowing that we can always get whoever. We can always get whoever, no matter where they think they are.
Back out in the yard, we cross paths with an ongoing investigation.
This is a unit on their way out again on a mission. These are freshly arrested suspects, and the team is getting ready to move out with them for further arrest, to trace their gang members, or maybe to search their houses for weapons or wherever they say their weapons are. Yes.
IRT often offers suspects incentives in return for leading officers to the rest of the gang.
I want to show you something now.
Okay. Yeah.
These are some of the weapons that we have recently recovered from bandits.
Wow.
They are about to go into storage.
Okay.
These are chain bullets and a general purpose machine gun.
Wow.
All of these were recovered recently during an operation in Benue State. These are sacks of ammunition. You can see them. All of them are recovered from hoodlums. Along with hand grenades and tear gas canisters. We also have here a rocket launcher, which we also recovered from the bandits. So you can see the level of their weaponry. We don't even use this in the police. Yeah, these are purely military hardware. Yeah, you know, not too many people understand that this is what we face on a daily basis, having to encounter people who are heavily armed and probably operating on hard drugs. So they're very daring with them, yes.
Sonny's insights are revealing, but I'm also anxious to meet IRT's number one man, the unit's founder and leader, Deputy Police Commissioner Abba Kyari.
Hello, Commander. Yes, sir.
Really great to meet you, sir.
Ms. Kunle, she's from the BBC.
He's the youngest high-ranking officer in the Nigerian police force. With an arrest sheet of notorious kidnappers and armed robbers that has earned him the nickname Nigeria's Jack Bauer. as well as a host of police medals and commendations.
When this place was set up, you were the first commander.
Yeah, here. Sure. I am the pioneer commander here.
What was the real idea? Was it felt that there is need for a unit that is solely based on intelligence?
You know, when this new administration came in, they decided that there should be a special unit that should be created, who are going to be trained on how to use intelligence to go out in the field and get the people arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So that unit is named the Intelligence Response Team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all about intelligence. So anybody that we're going to go after, we have to be sure of it before we go after the person. We just don't go blindly and arrest somebody to him. It's very important to send the message to the criminals that Gary and his people will follow you wherever you are, and they will never forget.
It's not long before I get a chance to see Abba Kyari in action. News is breaking of a major case in the troubled northwest states of Kaduna, one of Nigeria's main kidnapping hotspots. A traditional ruler in the southern part of the state has just been murdered in an apparent kidnapping gone wrong. The entire state has been placed under a 24-hour curfew. Abba Kyari has been charged by his superiors with traveling to the king's palace immediately and spearheading the investigation.
This kidnapping and the king has brought a lot of tension in the state. The whole country and the state are looking up to IRT to see that these guys are arrested and brought to justice. And we'll see to that.
The king initially looked like he would be handed back to his family after a ransom of 10 million naira or $30,000 was paid. But at the last moment, one of the kidnappers executed him instead with two gunshots to the head. On arrival at the palace, Abba Kyari is introduced to the late king's wife, Victoria Galadima, who was kidnapped alongside him, though she was later released. He asks how she was handled by the kidnappers.
This is the evidence of beating. I was tortured.
And mommy, they're like, how many?
They were nine.
Even when they were going with you inside the bush?
Yes, they were nine in number.
High profile case, the money I get for our government is solving the case then. So the guy said that the Faru, Aga Abunde Faru, the Kasana Sanji Kuma is very bad Abu. The Akai, to Shesa IG now directed Zoom Shigab investigation and then we should trace where in the industry Musamo so that they will come and face justice.
Mm-hmm.
That would escape.
But then the only thing you can do to give us the courage to believe that the government is concerned is to fish out these perpetrators of this evil act.
Yes, sir.
And bring them to justice, as you have said. We therefore say thank you, and we hope that you will do your work with us here on our favor. Thank you very much for coming. You are welcome.
This case threatens to ignite ethnic tensions in an already volatile region of Nigeria. It's essential that IRT's actions are swift and decisive if retaliatory violence is to be avoided. The king's driver, Timothy Kattari, was kidnapped alongside him and stayed with his chief to the end, narrowly escaping the same fate.
You can see where the bullet entered and came out.
Now, Timothy is recovering from his injuries in hospital.
The police
say it can build it and say, so I'm going to go back to the family.
They were marched around 25 kilometers into the thick bush. After 5 days, the kidnappers reduced the ransom and allowed their victims to communicate with the chief staff so the ransom could be delivered.
Around 5 o'clock, I came out of the hospital. The driver didn't allow me to get out of the hospital. sana ce a to in haka dina ne muna jin musu mota a kwalta su bar mu za mu kai to lokacin da ya same na nan ban ji ba kawai sai na ce wayo Allah sai na ga kawai sai ya wuna ma mai gira na ga kawai taw taw daga na ke gudu ba nan aka duba nan aka ganga mai gira na yana kwance ba
From what we discovered altogether, like 8 people have been killed by this group in this very operation. So it's an extremely deadly group.
Do you think that this same group might have been involved in some brutal kidnapping in the past where they've killed people?
Yes, it's possible. You know, there are so many other kidnappings where people have been killed around Kaduna all over. And it's all by this kind of people. I hope you understand.
Abba Kiari's investigation continues. We head out to the very stretch of road where 1 week earlier, Timothy, the king and the king's wife were taken from their vehicle and marched into the bush. And where four of their entourage were murdered in cold blood. District Police Officer John Hammond was the first policeman to respond to the scene and witness the carnage the kidnappers had left behind.
What are we looking at right now?
They are coming from this side. When they are coming from this side, the chief's vehicle stopped here.
Yeah.
So the orderly have noticed that there are armed robbers. So he removed his chevron from there. When he came here, they noticed that they discovered that he's a policeman because the horse of the pistol with him here. So when they noticed that they dragged him down, shooting.
Yeah, so, and you can see the spot where the bullet hit.
Yes.
You can see the small hole. So you can see that some people are already on the ground, and these guys went ahead to
shoot them in the head.
Them and kill them. So it's very sad, very bad. But by God's grace, we're going to get them. They will most surely answer for this thing.
You can see the other one here too. You can see the spot. This is where they just
fired the first. Yeah, it's pure this.
I'm telling you,
it's too sad.
Very, very sad.
Following a 6-month investigation, operators from IRT arrested the suspected ringleader and charged him with the kidnapping and murder of the king. But for thousands of other Nigerians, the trauma of kidnapping is something they must face alone, with little hope that their abductors will ever be brought to justice. I've arranged to meet two men who were freed from a kidnapping ordeal just 1 week earlier.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Sir? My name is Kunle.
I'm Paul.
Nice to
welcome to my home.
Nice to meet you.
Please come in.
Thank you.
Paul Dama and Spencer Nguto Tobago were kidnapped while driving along a major expressway. In recent years, Nigeria's highways have become high-risk kidnap zones.
I was the one driving, and it was around 4:30 p.m. We got to Ofu local government area in Kogi State. And then suddenly we heard a loud gunshot. And of course, I stepped off the accelerator. Then four or five of them came out from the bushes. All of them had AK-47 rifles, so the sound was quite loud. It was terrifying. They came out and were shooting sporadically in the air and pointing the guns at us in the car. And we came out of the car and they asked us to lie on the floor. And of course, at that moment, I felt that that was the end for me because I had never seen a gun to my face like that, not so close.
Paul and Spencer were forcefully marched into the deep forest for hours. Their captors only allowed them to stop once they were around 20 kilometers from the main road. Escape was now impossible.
They now told us that we had been kidnapped and that we were going to call our families and friends to begin to send money because they only let us go after the payment of a ransom of 10 million naira each.
How did that make you feel?
I was scared. I was really, really scared. Because I started to imagine the trauma my family members were going to go through.
Their friends and family were unable to raise such a huge sum. For 2 days, they begged the kidnappers to lower their demands while Paul and Spencer were beaten and tortured, often while their relatives listened on the phone.
They meant business because they were beating us and they were very serious. They told us that this is no joke, this is no play, this is the business they do. In fact, at that point, the first night they told us that there's a shrine they have, that when they want to kill you, they take you there and kill you.
Finally, the bandits agreed to 1 million naira in exchange for each of their lives. 4 days after they were lifted from the highway, a friend dropped the ransom cash off at the bandits' chosen location and both were released. They were lucky. In Nigeria, many kidnapping victims are killed by their captors, even after the ransom has been paid.
Are you the same person you were before you were kidnapped?
Absolutely not. It has really given me an entirely new perspective to life generally and what kidnapping in Nigeria is. So I think it's going to remain in my mind for a long time, I guess, before you. And I don't think it will ever go off.
I bet if you hear a gunshot now...
I'm going to be really, really, really scared. I don't even want to hear it.
1 week on from their release, Paul and Spencer's hopes for justice rest solely on the actions of Abba Kyari and his team.
I want them to face the full wrath of the law, because if we don't comb these things away from our society, we're in for serious trouble.
Paul and Spencer were kidnapped leaving the town of Anfa, traveling along one of the highways that link Abuja with the major towns and commercial centers of northern Nigeria. We're on the same stretch of road Paul and Spencer were taken from. IRT team leader Maji Mohammed has been assigned to investigate.
So what does each person here do?
Of course, I'm the team leader. I coordinate virtually everything in the team. Clement, he has a specialty in tracking.
Wow.
He traces the main target with the intelligence. Then James here, he has that skill. He has the major quality and ability to actually get to the target.
Based on Paul and Spencer's victim statements, IRT suspects a known kidnapping gang from the Fulani tribe is responsible for taking them. It's a high-risk operation, and the suspects have home advantage.
Is this the most dangerous stretch of road in Nigeria?
Yeah, it's amongst the most dangerous roads in Nigeria, because these are, as you can observe, there's no human life existing within this area. These are thick forest, very thick bush. So it's very, very dangerous, because you never can tell when they'll come out to strike, and that's a good hideout for the criminals.
According to IRT, 90% of kidnappers they have arrested in the past year have identified themselves as Fulani. Traditionally known as a peaceful people, the expansion of organized farming has driven the Fulanis off the pastoral lands they once grazed their cattle on. Left destitute but accustomed to surviving in the thick forests which line the highways, they have found themselves drawn into and uniquely well equipped for kidnapping. IRT's intelligence team has pinpointed one of the key suspects in the case. They're in luck. He's out of the bush and in town.
This is the perfect time to go after them because they are more relaxed now. They are not armed. They are within town. So we just need to go undercover. That's why I'm taking off my uniform. I don't want any identity or anything because we are going there fully on operation now. So.
The team goes straight into action and pick up the suspect. He's still in possession of a ransom phone. It even has a logo on the back associated with bandit groups based in the bush.
Mostly they use
the big source
from the Fulani.
From the Fulani.
They use for negotiation of the ransoms.
This is a major breakthrough in tracking down Paul and Spencer's kidnappers. The suspect appears ready to crack and gives up the man he says is the real mastermind behind the abduction. He's even prepared to set a trap.
My brother, the best wisdom is there. Relax,
relax, calm down. Now, I want it.
I will see that person where you will talk about the cow. The person is on radio, I will take it.
The man makes several attempts to call the alleged ring leader, but his phone is switched off. That evening, he sees his missed calls and rings back.
Okay, where are they now? Go to Korod. Okay, for one girl, we get yash. Okay, I'll come.
The team head out in an unmarked car, hoping to snatch the alleged ring leader. They find him in a bar with two other apparent gang members. The suspects are seized and taken into custody. The unit's main suspect is adamant he wasn't involved in the kidnapping. He says he's a simple cattle herder. Maji immediately tries to confirm the suspect's identity. He takes their photos and sends them back to the kidnapped victims.
I have his number. I just gave them some shots. I want him to identify them for me.
For now, there's already enough evidence to hold the suspects. These alleged bandits might be off the streets for now, but I can't help wondering whether these men will ever have access to a lawyer or if their families have even been informed where they are. IRT might be effective, but there are worrying signs that due process isn't always top of their priority list. The suspects are marched into the cells of a local police station. I want to get a better insight into what has driven young men across the country into joining these brutal kidnapping gangs. So I'm traveling south to where the kidnapping epidemic started, the oil-rich Niger Delta. It all started with the kidnapping of foreign oil workers, and when criminals realized how much money was involved, kidnapping spread nationwide. You get a sense of the danger once you enter the region, that kidnapping here can occur anywhere, anytime. In 2006, Niger Delta militant groups, angered by the unequal distribution of the region's oil wealth, began kidnapping foreign oil workers, plucking them from ships and refinery platforms on the high seas and holding them for huge ransoms. But what began as a protest soon spiraled into a multi-million dollar criminal enterprise affecting Nigerians at all levels of society. And for a lot of young people here, kidnapping is not just a source of livelihood. It's a way of life, one they're willing to die or kill for. Through my contact, I've managed to find an active kidnapper who is willing to talk. Like hundreds of other young men in the region, he made the journey from militant to professional kidnapper. He's insisted that we anonymize him as a condition of the interview.
So what made you decide that this is the time to start kidnapping?
Before I start the kidnapping, federal government, they went and attacked one of my community. They killed my brother, killed my sister, killed my daughter before I joined the game. And everybody, they did not have water, they did not have light, those people. They did not have any food to eat. And when my boys are hungry, they will call me, "Ah, boss man, there is no money for us to feed. Let us go and fish." When we are going for kidnapping, we call it fishing. You understand?
The profits from kidnapping can be huge, but so are the dangers.
Everybody are joining this game. know that one day you must die. So before you leave your house, you know that you have already signed your death. It's a life and death game.
He insists whatever steps he's taken since, it has always been for the greater good.
The last kidnapping that I did last year, I get up to 700 or something million naira. Now, when you go to my community, they have a standard light now. And my men, all of them, are feeding very well. So anything that I'm doing, I am doing the sake of my boys.
How many people would you say that he's killed?
I have killed more than 50 persons.
It is actually tough to look into the eyes of someone who says to you that he has killed up to 50 people before. At every point in the interview, I was expecting to see some glimmer of remorse. But I didn't see that at any point in time. And this sort of gives me a better understanding of how tough the war against kidnapping must be in Nigeria.
The outbreak, which started in the Niger Delta, has now spread to all corners of my country. But IRC's founder and leader, Commander Abakiari, insists his men can solve Nigeria's kidnap crisis. He wants to prove it to me. Just 1 year ago, this expressway linking Abuja with Kaduna, one of the commercial capitals of Northwest Nigeria, was a national kidnap hotspot.
There are about 20 different groups. By and large, we have arrested about 18 of those groups, or even 19. There's only one group that is remaining. We have brought down kidnapping along this expressway from 10 kidnapping per day to less than one kidnapping in a month. Yes?
The cells of the local police station are filled with alleged Fulani kidnappers removed from the highway by Kyari's men over the last year. Young men like Habib, currently awaiting trial. Habib admits he ran with a kidnapping gang before his arrest by IRT officers this year, and even to his involvement in the murder of four victims in one botched operation. But he says he had no choice.
When you kidnap someone, what do you do to them?
He describes how powerful Fulani tribesmen lured young men into committing criminal acts in return for payment, then used this to trap them into gang life. Once they have joined a gang, young men like Habib claim they must do whatever is asked of them or face dire consequences. How are you feeling when they were being killed, when they were being beaten and they were being killed?
Yeah, kaji lokacin da ake dukan su sannan aka kashe su.
Gaskiya abun bai bani da
he say he didn't feel comfortable.
He da ya mutu ya iya zai sha hala tun da ko ni he da gube.
Okay.
Now that particular operation where four people were killed, how much were you giving them? So you got 10,000?
Yes, into four.
Okay, for each victim?
For each victim.
So you got 40,000 naira?
Yes.
To kill four people.
I can't believe that Habib was willing to conspire to kidnap and even murder his fellow citizens for just $25 a go. It shows just how desperate and poor these young Fulani men are.
If you think back about what you've done now, do you feel bad about killing these people?
Idan ka tuna abin da ya faru, ya kake ji a jikin kana jin dadi? Akan
domin Allah ba ni jin dadi tunda da anje ya kira an tawa da ya yake san mu buge mu to.
Yes, he's not feeling happy, he's not comfortable.
Domin Allah,
he's not comfortable. They just force him to do that. They are not happy while carrying the kidnapping and killing.
But that's what they normally say when you catch them. Yeah. You see, there is a boss somewhere that is ordering him.
You see the family of these four people that your gang killed. What would you say to them?
So he will ask for forgiveness.
Habib's story is a familiar one to Abakiari and his men. They have dealt with countless cases like this before, but the team also have their eyes on far bigger targets. I'm at the CID headquarters to meet a man who spearheaded what is seen as one of the unit's greatest victories.
They are responsible for the kidnapping of Chibok girls and several other kidnappings that has been carried out by the Boko Haram terrorists.
Sergeant Joseph Ulaju is nicknamed the Bushmaster after his multiple successes tracking kidnappers. But his biggest achievement is the capture of these alleged Boko Haram terror group members. One of them stands accused of kidnapping 276 schoolgirls from the town of Chibok in 2014. He is arranged for me to meet two of the suspects, Mainta Alhaji Madu and Adam Mustafa. Mainta has already confessed to playing a key role in the kidnap of the schoolgirls. The militants transported the girls to fortified Boko Haram camps deep inside the Sambisa forest. Many were forced into marriage with senior militants. Others were raped on a daily basis throughout their captivity.
They said they are crying. The children
are crying.
What did you think of yourself as being a kidnapper at that time?
You say it doesn't feel good.
Though he admits helping to kidnap the girls, Mainta insists he never took advantage of them.
Are you aware that the girls were being raped?
No, no, I'm the last one to say that I don't feel that.
Some of
them, the senior members, they carry the girls.
Okay, but you see the leaders raping these girls all the time.
But the second man, Adam Mustafa, certainly appears to have been involved in the exploitation of young vulnerable women. He says he was paid by Boko Haram to turn them into highly effective suicide bombers.
When they kidnap them from villages, how do they prepare them to become suicide bombers?
They will bring them to closer to the city. Tramon, then how many milligrams? 200 milligrams.
How many girls have you sent to a death like that?
Yatum Pongandao, Yatum Nado, Yikama.
Ah,
Dando.
I like a man.
I'm the Omar or not, then you can buy a Yacha number than that.
Are you saying that after many years of operating in Boko Haram, you can't even account for how many people that you've killed?
Say it's more than 50.
I'm shocked by Adam Mustafa's confession, but IRT claimed to have connected him to no less than 133 suicide bombings in the town where he operated. Maiduguri. Interrogators believe the vast majority of those detonations were carried out by the victims of kidnapping. According to UNICEF, Boko Haram have kidnapped more than 1,000 children in northern Nigeria since 2013.
So for every girl that you send to carry a bomb and send to her death, how much do you get paid?
You do it because of the money alone.
Yet he himself is still asking for clemency. It's a story I've heard from most of the kidnappers I've met. I was forced to do it. I had no choice. But their victims may not find it so easy to forgive and forget. On my final day embedded with the unit, Commander Abakiari wants us to meet a family who know all about the cost of bringing Adam and young men like him to justice.
Where we're heading to now is the house of one of our late Inspector Maman. He's one of the gallant officers that was killed during one of the anti-kidnapping operations. He died directly in the line of duty. In fact, this is the saddest moment since the unit was created.
IRT's successes have come at a heavy price. Since the unit was formed, 12 officers have died in shootouts with armed criminals. We walk through a series of dusty streets till we come to the house of the IRT officer's widow. Fatima Abdullahi and her 4 children live in a small dwelling and are struggling to get by. Fatima should be due a state pension as her husband was killed in the line of duty. But 4 months after his death, no financial support has arrived. According to Abakiari, this state of affairs is all too common for public servants in Nigeria, and one of the key obstacles to creating a better police force nationally.
For the country to take care of our heroes is very, very, very important, because this will increase tremendously the morale of the men out there in the field. When they see that if they are injured, the government will take good care of them, get the best medical treatment. If they can see that their colleagues that died in the line of duty, their families have been taken care of by the government, you will see that those men in the field will be ready to fight for their country, will be ready to stand for their country, and they will be ready to take the bullet for their country.
I've seen considerable evidence of how effective IRT has been in combating kidnapping gangs in the north. But in another part of the country, worrying reports are emerging. I've come to Lagos to meet June, not her real name. Her husband was a suspect in a major kidnapping case under investigation by IRT. In a bid to get to him, a group of IRT officers allegedly picked June up off the streets. She claims they then tried to force her to give up her husband's location by subjecting her to forced imprisonment, torture, and degrading treatment for several days.
On that very day, in the morning, I got an SMS that I have a DHL parcel. And I didn't call the number because I know that I'm not expecting any parcel from anybody. They called back again. They asked me the closest bus stop to my area. I told them it's Olowunla bus stop. They said, okay. So when I got there, I saw 4 men. They are not in uniform. They are mufti. They said that I should enter the car. I said, I don't know you people. How can you just come? So all of them, they just hit me, bundled me inside the car. They brought out a gun and said they are going to shoot me if I don't close my mouth.
June says the IRT officers drove her to the Lagos State Police headquarters. There, they placed her in a cell alongside other prisoners.
They now say that they want my husband. I said, he's not around. I'm not my husband. Why should you come and pick me just like that? That they should please leave me, let me go. that I have a baby, a 1 year plus baby. They say no, that they are not going to release me, that I'm going to stay there for 4 months. And I'm begging them, please, can I make call and call my people? They say no, that I'm not going to make any call, that nobody will know where I am, that I will rot in the cell there. I say rot in the cell, that please, for the sake of my baby, please, can I go? If I just mention it, they'll start beating me.
Periodically, officers will take her out of the cell to an office inside the station where June claims they will interrogate and torture her. The final time this happened was, she says, the most brutal.
The man brought me out and took me to the Oga's office again and said that I lied to them. So they beat me up like 5 policemen. One of them hit me. You can see a scar there, here. One of them hit me on the forehead here. That was when I fainted, when blood started splitting all their office.
How did it make you feel being in custody and not knowing what in particular you've done wrong?
I feel so bad. I never know that somebody will come and pick somebody that didn't do anything or have any connection with any crime at all in her life, because all my life I've not been to a police custody in my life.
And while you were in custody, what sort of treatment did you see was meted out to other inmates that were inside the cell with you?
They used to hang them. They would tie their hand back, tie their leg, and hang them up. So blood...
Are you saying they hang women like that? They hung women like that?
Yes. That the blood will just enter your eyes, your head, everything. When they hang you, anything they ask you, you say yes. Even if they tell you that you kill your father, you kill your mother, you say yes.
Are you sure that the IRC members were the ones who did this?
They are the ones who did it. They are the ones.
It's impossible for us to verify whether IRT officers did indeed engage in this horrific punishment. June has turned to local civil society group, the Network on Police Reform in Nigeria, or NOPRIN, in a bid to get justice. Okechukwu Nwaguma is NOPRIN's national coordinator. He says June's experience reflects a regular pattern of behavior by IRT officers operating out of Lagos.
The truth is that IRT has been able to crack a very good number, very high numbers of, you know, violent crimes, armed robbery, kidnapping. And because of that, Nigerians always see IRT, particularly Abakiri, as a hero. But many Nigerians are not aware, or even if they are aware, they are willing to overlook the excesses, the way IRT treats criminal suspects while in their custody, and which for us is an issue of major concern.
Now, what has your findings unearthed about the way they treat suspects?
You know, torture, enforce disappearances, and then trying to force relatives of some of their suspects to confess to, you know, sometimes they even write statements for them and compel them to sign.
How complicit would you say that the leadership of IRT is in all these things you've talked?
I don't have any evidence that Abakiri as a person has been involved, but officers under him have been involved, and these have been brought to his attention, but he hasn't done enough, in our view, to address the particular officers whose names keep coming up, to bring them to account.
A lot of Nigerians who may not understand your motive will say, why are you so concerned about fighting for the side of the criminal suspects rather than fighting for the welfare of those who go out to look for them?
We are not necessarily fighting on the side of criminal suspects. What we're saying is that they go about abusing legally established arrest and detention procedures. For instance, when you arrest somebody, you must allow the person access to family, access to lawyer, access to Medicare. You don't detain indefinitely and fail to charge the person to court. So that's the point we're making. If somebody is arrested as a criminal, charge the person to court. Don't violate basic human rights. That is the point we're making.
The testimony I've heard in Lagos is alarming. So my return to Abuja, I arrange a final meeting with Commander Abba Kyari. I want to ask him directly about allegations that some of his men are involved in widespread human rights abuses.
You have offices or facilities all over the country. Is it a challenge controlling your men, many of whom have been accused of human rights abuses?
Okay, you know, we have been handling hundreds of cases, and then when you get complaint about 2, 3, 4 cases, then you expect us to have zero complaint. I hope you understand. And any complaint that comes to us, we look into it. If we see that our officer is found wanted, we normally take action on him. If you find out there is somebody that has been arrested for armed robbery and kidnapping, yes, you listen to him, but you investigate whatever you hear from him. Don't believe him just like that. All those guys that have been killing innocent citizens, they want to continue. But who stopped them? We risked our lives to stop them. To stop them from killing, to stop them from making money from innocent citizens that they have been killing. And do you think they would like us? You know, these are things they do in order to try to get freedom. And they will go and still talk that they were tortured, they were this, they were that. All lies, no criminal wants to be convicted. Let them prove it. I hope you understand.
What you said just now brought to mind one of the cases, one of the people who came to us, the wife of a suspect.
This is the same case I'm talking to you about.
Actually, what the woman said was that she was tortured. They actually strung up some suspects in custody that she was detained in Lagos.
You know, they have to write all these lies. The kidnapper's family have to write all these things for you people to listen to them. There's nothing that I hate so much in my life that an innocent person to complain against me. But if a criminal will go and complain against me, let him complain. I'm ready to fight that criminal to the last. Let him prove it. I hope you understand. When you fight crime, the same criminal will fight back. I hope you understand. We know it. Before we came out to fight the crime, we knew that they will fight back. So we are ready for them.
Speaking with the commander, I came to realize that this unit is not immune to the allegations of human rights abuses, which have been something associated with the Nigeria police for many years. I also realized that this war is very tough. This unit is led by a very determined man, but is operating in a broken system where corruption is endemic. The threat of kidnapping has now become a fact of life for most Nigerians. It may take us generations to address the issues that have turned so many of our young men into violent criminals. But for now, what Nigerians desperately need is a police force that can bring the rule of law back to our country.